Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump and the Saudi king signed agreements today that would forge a partnership between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia worth $110 billion. Earlier, President Trump was presented with the highest civilian honor Saturday during a meeting at the royal court in Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh. President Trump also spoke about the second stop on his 9-day trip abroad, Israel, during his weekly address.
Israel is an important American ally, but in recent years, we haven't always treated them that way. It's time to renew our friendship. While I'm there, I'll also meet with President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority in Bethlehem to discuss ways to advance peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
Some observers find Mr. Trump's visit to the Middle East surprising in wake of his America First rhetoric and campaign statements calling for a Muslim ban backed by subsequent orders attempting to limit travel from six Muslim-majority countries. Saudi Arabia was not named in the travel bans. Mr. Trump will also visit Europe. The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee says former FBI Director James Comey has agreed to testify publicly about Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Meantime, the New York Times reported President Trump told Russian officials earlier this month that Trump said Comey spying had eased pressure on him regarding the Russia probe. White House spokesman Sean Spicer said there was never any attempt to interfere in the investigation. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. President Trump has ordered an accelerated operation against the Islamic State jihadists in Syria. Defense Chief Jim Mattis called it a tactical shift.
We are leading a comprehensive international campaign to crush ISIS' claim of invincibility, to deny ISIS a geographic haven from which to hatch murder.
As the ISIS fighters continue to lose ground, they've started using civilians as human shields, killing those who attempt to flee. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has won re-election, beating out his closest opponent, a hardline cleric. Rouhani banked his political future on Iran's landmark nuclear deal with the United States and other world powers, which led to the loosening of economic sanctions on Tehran. Philippine leader Rodrigo Duterte says Chinese President Xi Jinping threatened him with war if the Philippines begins drilling for oil in a disputed part of the South China Sea. Mr. Duterte spoke with reporters.
This is ours, and we intend to drill oil there. Wala nang palaboy-laboy. If it's yours, well, that is your view, but my view is that I can drill the oil if there is some inside the bowels of the earth, because it is out.
President Duterte said she gave him a firm but friendly warning when they met in Beijing 5 days ago. Political observers said Duterte's frank account of the conversation in the Chinese capital could infuriate China. Families of the 82 Nigerian schoolgirls released from captivity recently after being held for years by Boko Haram were reunited for the first time Saturday in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. The girls were among the 276 Chibok schoolgirls abducted from their boarding school by the terrorists in 2014. They were granted freedom as part of a prisoner exchange deal between Boko Haram and the Nigerian government. Nigerian officials say they believe the militants kidnapped the girls to intimidate civilians against resistance. An attack on southern Libyan airbase has left at least 141 people dead, mostly soldiers in the Libyan National Army. A militia spokesman said Friday's attack on the airbase was carried out by militia loyal to the UN-backed government of National Accord in Tripoli. Spokesman said the unarmed soldiers were returning from a military parade when they were executed. The GNA condemned the attack and denied any involvement. And two car bombings in southwestern Baghdad killed 19 people, including four police officers, and wounded at least 20 other people late Friday night. Authorities say the attack targeted a police checkpoint. Moments later, the second blast hit a nearby street crowded with civilians. The Islamic State is claiming responsibility for the attack. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting here in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
One of the units cleared three villages and they were able to rescue 998 persons and also immunize children and recover some weapons, Boko Haram terrorist flags, and quite a number of them were equally killed by the force.
The Nigerian military rescues over 900 people from Boko Haram.
We launched a report that looks at human rights violations and abuses which occurred between July 2016 until January 2017 in the area in and around Yei.
A United Nations report documents human rights violations committed by the South Sudanese National Army.
Normally, Electoral Commission of Lesotho is working hand in hand with all the stakeholders, including political parties, media, and non-governmental organizations.
And the Independent Electoral Commission of the Kingdom of Lesotho receives ballot papers to be used for the upcoming elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian military has rescued over 900 people being held captive by Islamist militant group Boko Haram on Friday. Military spokesman Brigadier General Sani Kukashika Usman says nine of the militants were killed after the Nigerian soldiers repelled Boko Haram attacks in some villages around Ingala. He says the military also seized several weapons and destroyed a factory the militants used to manufacture improvised explosive devices. For an update regarding the latest rescue, I reached military spokesman Brigadier General Sani Kukashika Usman.
Well, as you are quite aware, we have continued with the crack clearance operations that we've been doing, and it's achieving the desired result. The operation you are talking about actually was more or less at the areas of Ran and Kala Balige, general area. If you are talking about the operation of yesterday, in which one of the units cleared three villages and they were able to rescue 998 persons and also immunize children and recover some weapons, Boko Haram terrorist flags, and quite a number of them were equally killed by the force. But aside that, other formations have intensified clearance operations wherever we have information Boko Haram terrorists have been hibernating.
So are these Boko Haram militants still in part of the Sambisa forest?
Well, you know, it's a very vast area. They have been hiding in some remote villages, and you hardly, because they don't have means of identification, unless the local were able to tell you that actually such number or such person or such village is infiltrated by the terrorists, you hardly. But the good thing is that they no longer have any place to hide. More or less, they have been moving from one point to another, and our troops in various blocking positions have been clearing them.
With this latest round of rescue, who did you rescue? Women, children, men inclusive?
Mostly women and children. And that is why the good thing about it is that we have even gone beyond the normal operation. We are also embarking on humanitarian assistance.
There were reports that morale is low among the soldiers in the field because of allegations of not properly being equipped and they are not being fed and all that. How do you react to that?
That is not true. For anybody to say that the person is just saying something that is far from the truth about it, because first and foremost, the morale is always very high. And I don't know of any unit that is complaining of equipment and maybe payment of allowances and salary.
There were reports that the intelligence gathering of the army has been weakened because of the way Boko Haram militants have been treating residents in the areas they control. Because as soon as they learn that they are providing information to the military, they are executed. How do you cope with that?
Well, that it is not correct to say that the intelligence gatherance is weakened. Far from it. As a matter of fact, it has never been so strong like it is now. And that is why we are achieving the desired response. All these things that you are hearing, they were just mere propaganda because Boko Haram are no longer controlling any territory whatsoever. So it's just mere speculation.
Boko Haram has threatened to attack the Nigerian capital, Abuja, and they said they are regrouping in the Sambisa forest and that people should be aware that they are coming. How concerned should residents in the capital be?
If you listen to, or rather watch the video clip, he even personally mentioned my name. And what I said is that it is sheer propaganda, and that is what terrorism thrive on. It is far from the reality. They no longer have the capability and capacity to even survive, talk less of carrying out such attacks as promised. And apart from that, whatever information we have, we don't take it with liberty. We make sure that we follow it to, you know, the letter. So we have been doing the very best we could, and we know for sure they cannot do that. But that notwithstanding, we are responsible enough to take adequate security measures. And I know, as of yesterday, the Assistant Inspector General of Police in charge of operations also gave assurance that the Federal Capital Territory is secure. So I don't think people should have anything to worry about that propaganda.
Brigadier General Sani Kukashika Usman is the Nigerian military spokesman. He spoke with me from the Sambisa Forest. A United Nations report released Friday documents human rights violations committed by the Sudan's People's Liberation Army. The report followed an investigation into human rights violations committed in and around Ye Town. The report by the Human Rights Division of the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, and the UN Human Rights Office documents violations and abuses against civilians by both sides of the conflict. This, the report says, was based on ethnicity and sometimes their presumed support for the opposing side. Julie Diriveru, the human rights chief of Eastern and Southern Africa at the United Nations, told me the international community needs to act to help resolve the conflict in South Sudan.
We launched a report that looks at human rights violations and abuses which occurred between July 2016 until January 2017 in the area in and around Ye. This was an area that was previously unaffected by the conflict, that was previously a very peaceful area where many different ethnic communities lived together. Unfortunately, we see the conflict spreading now into new areas of South Sudan. And here we've registered horrific violations of human rights, including killings, including sexual violence against women and girls, as well as detention and other types of cases.
Julie, how many people were affected by this incident of violence meted out to residents in and around Ye?
Well, it's estimated that the population of Ye is about 200,000 to 300,000 people, and most of them have been affected in one way or another by the conflict. There have been many thousand people leaving this area to displace themselves internally or even going to neighboring countries of the DRC and of Uganda. So I would say thousands of people have been affected. We documented specifically 114 cases of killings. These were killings that were committed by government forces or forces supporting the government. But we were unable to really investigate abuses committed by the opposition because we were denied access to areas that are controlled by the opposition, by the government.
Usually when such reports come, the government sharply rejects it. I believe probably you have presented your findings to the administration in Juba.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we gave them an advanced version of the report at the beginning of the month so that they could, provide us with any factual inaccuracies. But unfortunately, up until now, they have denied the bulk of human rights violations that we have recorded. And in fact, although there have been many commitments towards the ceasefire, towards securing peace, the violations have, continued, and they remain, in impunity, I would say.
What necessitated this investigation? Because South Sudan in its entirety was engulfed in this conflict. So what motivated this investigation in and around Yei?
It was particularly because Yei had been an area that hadn't been affected previously by the conflict. So this was something new that we were seeing there. And it had a big effect on the ethnic dimensions of the conflict because, previous communities that were able to live together no longer were able to, because a lot of the violations that happened both on the opposition side and the government side often targeted people for their perceived affiliation to one or the other or because of their ethnicity. So that came out quite strongly in our investigations.
Your investigators made several efforts to contact the opposition side. Are these efforts still ongoing to find out the real nature of what is happening in the jurisdictions they control?
Yes, we have human rights officers that are constantly trying to reach victims in different areas controlled by the opposition, but often the access is denied, and often that access is in fact denied by the government. So it makes it very difficult for us to be able to corroborate the allegations that we receive. So this is one of the difficulties of doing human rights work in South Sudan.
Julie De Rivero is the Human Rights Chief of Eastern and Southern Africa at the United Nations. She spoke with me from Geneva. The Independent Electoral Commission of the Kingdom of Lesotho received ballot papers to be used for the June 3rd elections on Thursday. Printed in neighboring South Africa, the ballot papers are being guarded by security officers, political parties, and other stakeholders. Lesotho will hold its third elections in 5 years after Prime Minister Pakadita Musisidi lost a no-confidence vote and subsequently dissolved parliament. For the latest development about the elections, I read Toe Hansi, a spokesman for the Independent Electoral Commission.
Normally, the Electoral Commission of Lesotho is working hand-in-hand with all the stakeholders, including political parties, media, and non-governmental organizations, including the police as well. So the ballot paper was collected from Republic of South Africa in Durban. It came with all those stakeholders that I have just mentioned throughout, and it was welcomed on Thursday by the chairperson of IEC Lesotho. He made a brief, welcomed everyone who was in that delegation from South Africa, and then the ballot paper was taken to the central warehouse of Lesotho, whereby it will be guided by the police, political parties, from day to day until it is now dispatched to the district, from district to the constituency, from constituencies to polling centers, but with the same magnitude or same people who have received it. And we are heading for advanced voting next week, Saturday, and the embassies will be voting, on the 27th.
Are there any international observers the Independent Electoral Commission has invited to monitor these elections?
And it's like we are going to have the biggest number ever, because so far we have approved more than 600 international observers.
When do you plan on distributing these ballot papers that you've gotten across the country in readiness for the election?
This week, Wednesday, the ballot paper will be distributed to various districts and constituencies for advance voting. And since they are voting on the 27th, which is next week, Saturday, so the rest of the ballot paper will be dispatched and distributed Wednesday next week, which will be maybe 30 or more.
How has campaigning ahead of the elections been so far?
The campaigns are good, and they know and they always observe that the last day for campaigning should be 24 hours before polling day. So obviously, the main campaigns or the last campaigns will be next week, Sunday, which will be the 28th of this month.
The Independent Electoral Commission recently came up with a statement warning political parties not to undermine the integrity of the Electoral Commission. Why did the IEC issue such a statement?
There is this apathy that independent electoral commissioners are not independent. They get their mandate from somewhere else. So it was just affirming and assuring that, no, we as independent electoral commission of Lesotho, we are independent and very autonomous when it comes to decision making.
Has the IEC addressed all their concerns? Because they might have concerns. That is why they said some of these commissioners might not necessarily be independent. Have you addressed their concerns in the run-up to the election next week?
According to us, it's a matter of just politicking, because the processes in which the commissioners are engaged are very transparent. We set applications for commissioners. They advertise. All the processes are followed until the state council can choose from the best six candidates. That's where we get our best three people.
So how has been the cooperation with these political parties ahead of the elections?
So far, so good. It's true that there will be misunderstanding there and there, or as we are working together, we will feel that someone is stepping on someone's toes. So in a way, we are trying to solve some differences there and there, like vote buying, which is barred by electoral code of conduct. But then we have got a tribunal which is solving such matters, tribunal in the form of IEC court. So obviously there are some incidences whereby some political parties are not happy or IEC is not happy with some act. But in all, what is happening, there is a cooperation, because like I said, to and from Durban to collect the ballot paper, and even now, where it is now, there are political parties' representations where the ballot paper is.
Toye Hansi is the spokesman for the Independent Electoral Commission of the Kingdom of Lesotho. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. There are growing calls to investigate cases of torture by Ugandan security forces, especially at the notorious Nalufenya police facility in the Eastern Jinja district. The human rights organization Human Rights Watch has also condemned the practice of torturing suspects to elicit confessions and says officers who commit torture should be sacked, as police shouldn't be allowed to commit crimes while seeking to fight them. Maria Burnett is the Associate Director at Human Rights Watch Africa Division. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached her in Washington and began by asking her how pervasive was torture by police in Uganda.
It's very interesting that this is coming up, because frankly there are allegations that police are torturing suspects in Uganda very, very frequently. We've done many reports on this issue over the last decade, and the Uganda Human Rights Commission pretty much consistently lists the police as the number one abuser in the country, particularly the use of torture during interrogation. So this is not a new event. I think what's come to light in the last few weeks is that that suspects in high-profile cases have allegedly been tortured, particularly in the case of the murder of police spokesperson Andrew Kawesi, because they were in court in a case in which there was a lot of media present, because their wounds were quite visible. It has clearly catalyzed a new discussion about the use of torture in Uganda, but sadly, it's a pervasive problem.
Just this week, the president, Yoweri Museveni, gave a half-hearted rebuke to the police for torturing suspects. But he didn't seem to condemn the practice itself. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it was an interesting statement. First of all, I think it's important for a president to speak out on the use of torture, and there were certainly things in that statement that were true. It's true you may torture the wrong person, but that doesn't make torture legal, and it's true that people may admit to things that they didn't actually do. But what he didn't say was more important than what he said. He did not remind Ugandans, and the police in particular, that torture is illegal, both under Uganda's constitution, under Uganda's international human rights commitments, and now there is an actual criminal law that says that, you know, torturers can face criminal penalty. That's a new law in Uganda, but the anti-torture law has been there for a couple of years. It has never been used in any actual case. He also did not actually call for accountability or investigations, given the allegations that have been made and the documentation of torture. You know, this would be a clear time for him to insist on an investigation into the use of torture to ensure that those investigations happened and that perpetrators were brought to account. He did not insist that that happen or call for clarity and transparency so that there would be accountability.
And the Inspector General of Police, General Kale Kaihura's contract was renewed this the same week. Given that he's the head of the police, is there hope for change?
I think there always has to be an insistence on accuracy and demands for accountability. General Kaihura has been in that post for quite a long time. I think there are real concerns about torture by police. I can tell you, I myself have had many conversations with him raising cases of torture, and not only torture, in some cases, torture leading to the deaths of suspects in the custody of his units. You know, we had a lot of exchange in 2011 where a particular unit of police, the Rapid Response Unit, we found was responsible for many, many, many cases of torture. And at that time, he disbanded that unit later in the year. So that was seen. I mean, he clearly wanted to see that people gave him credit for disbanding that unit due to human rights abuses. The problem is, yet again, there was no investigation or accountability. And so clearly the people who ran that unit have simply been moved around, re-hatted into a new unit, potentially even now the ones who are involved in these cases. That's very difficult to prove, but without any systematic investigations, we don't really know that. So certainly we would expect that General Kaihura would take steps to ensure that his officers face accountability. We have a lot of concerns about the use of the Professional Standards Unit of Police, which should be the sort of internal police monitoring unit. And we've also had a lot of concerns about the use of police disciplinary courts, sort of administrative measures, to shield police from facing criminal charges in some cases. You know, that is, they can face a reduction in salary or potentially a demotion or administrative leave, which is not the appropriate punishment for committing the crime of torture.
Maria Burnett is the Associate Director at Human Rights Watch Africa Division. She spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Washington. The slum of Kibera in the Kenyan capital Nairobi is one of Africa's largest informal settlements. It's home to more than 500,000 inhabitants who live in single-room mud huts and tin shacks crammed closely together. The narrow paths between are often open sewers. There's no proper sanitation and little electricity. Anthony Omolo is a senior program officer with Kibera Community Development Agenda. It was established in 2002 by the slum dwellers with the aim of alleviating poverty and improving the lives of people living in the informal settlements. For VOA reporter Ruben Chiama asked him about his organization's achievements.
We've been doing community sensitization on the World Funds. That is talking about funds that are coming from the central government to the county government to initiate projects that includes and not limited to water projects, access to water, access to health, access to education, and then social security. And these are the basic human needs that without, then life would be difficult for any human being even to stay here in Kibera. Again, we are talking about peace. This is a cosmopolitan place or constituency whereby the 42 tribes are living here or residing here. Without this, then we may not achieve development that we eagerly await to achieve.
What are the most pressing needs in Kibera, for example? Are things getting better?
As well as you know, this is an informal settlement where we have a lot of people, close to 800,000 living here. Remember, access to health and education is still a challenge, because based on those projects and based on the population, then it doesn't match. We still need to have public health hostels, public institutions like playground and all things like that, so that our children, even after coming from school, they can get playgrounds and even capacity building centers. Those are still a challenge in Kibera for young people. And that's why you can see the rate of unemployment is too high here in Kibera, even if people graduate. But where do they go to work?
Are there new projects about your work that you are probably beginning?
Yeah, right now what we are doing, we are trying to sensitize the young people to be self-employed in terms of development of skills hands-on. So those are the things that right now we are looking into and ensure that every person or every young people is engaged in those particular activities so that they are self-dependent and move away from hooliganism.
Tell us a little bit about the political process, because Kenya is gearing up for an election. Do the residents, for example, do they participate in the national, local elections? And also, is it making a difference?
Actually, here it's chaotic, because now people vote for you according to the money that you have, and not education, and not the vision, and not the manifesto. You give the money, then they'll vote you in. The reason is because of poverty. If at all, they would have changed from that, whereby they vote for development-oriented persons or people or leaders, then we can achieve a lot.
Anthony Omolo is a senior program officer with Kibera Community Development Agenda. He spoke with reporter Ruben Chiama from Nairobi. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And it's now time for music from our African collection.
Baby, mo, nifanye bigiji, unitafune, ama niwe sindano. Na wewe huzi nguo nifume ama niwe ndo uwe maji yangu na wanume nifanye kucha kama ukiwashwa mimi kukune sema mama niwe duka la vipodozi nikuvutie kwa kila kitu chumbani uwe simu unalia hata nikikubipu nisimame kama kinyozi nikikunyoa unanisifu niwe godoro na shuka nilale nawe kila usiku kafunguo gari ya bosi wangu kwa kuzeze Zezeta. Niko radhi nifunge ule wewe Mimi zezeta, zezeta Aunataka ate nyumba ya baba yangu Koko zezeta, zezeta Kifaranga ni bebe kama mwewe Mimi zezeta, zezeta Mama, sitaki paka napanya vita za nini Minataka niwe mafuta Ukipaka zekote mwilini yeah. Ama Niwe taulo kangalaini Ukioga nina kufuta Kutoka jumpaka kwa chini Mashala Ulivomeza kuhutabani Naishi mchumba sendi varanda Tena Sikufanyi vocha soko dukani Nikutumie mchumba kutupe jalala Sema mama Niwe duka la vipodozi Nikuvutie kwa kila kitu Chumba ni uwe simu Gari ya bosi wangu Kwa kuzezeta, zezeta Niko radhi nifunge ule wewe Mimi zezeta, zezeta Aunataka ate nyumba ya baba yangu Kwa kuzezeta, zezeta Kifaranga ni bebe kama mwewe Mimi zezeta, zezeta Shika funguo gari ya bosi wangu Kwa kuzezeta, zezeta Niko radhi nifunge ule wewe Mimi zezeta, zezeta Aunataka ate nyumba ya baba yangu Kwa kuzezeta, zezeta Kifaranga ni bebe kama mwewe Zezeta, zezeta Mashila wadu Wananyapia, nyapia Mashila wadu Wananyatia, nyatia Mashila wadu Wapate kutangazia Mashila wadu Kwa makini mama Mashila wadu Wakudandia, dandia Mashila wadu Vya watu kupakazia Mashila wadu Machofunika fazia Mashila wadu Kwa makini mama
Presenting for your reason.
Don't go ba.
You got a million in the cook.
Don't go ba.
I'm about to see Bagalacusule.
Don't go ba.
You got
tondaba evident kwagala yagala paka kumbaka kwa bakali lugambo baby tombega kwagala you me life every day girl no every day me do me I do it for you sexy girl you the best baba singa bona benalinda vya kungudozo mu Kampala wano
tongoba tongoba
bigali wa miliani nebakuga
abizale tongoba tongoba
aba batesi bakala kusule bakuyaye
tongoba tongoba
bigali wa miliani nebakuga
we bigane
ninadirumbere
adamu nga gwe eva olaba otya ku ssimu nga gwe screen saver galuyimba lwa judith babiri oliko feva kwagala nnyonyonyo nga linnyo we liva kukakasa ekigambo kulayo genda kyerabira kuba buli njala weekuluma piza ng'eyingira tandika okweraliikirira olinnya amadaala kuba nkutwala mu kalina gyogenda esula tandika okweraliikirira n'okutomera kuba nkutwala mu bonji motoka kwerondera Obulamu bugera kuterera
Atongoba, tongoba
Bigali wa miliani neba kugamba
Abizale Tongoba, tongoba
Aba batesi bagala kusule bakuyaye
Tongoba, tongoba
Bigali wa miliani neba kugamba
Bigali Tongoba, tongoba
Aba batesi bagala kusule bakulonde Onda kanyumira baby tongoba Mulwate ya nonya doctor tondaba Everything bagala yagala baka kumbaga Kwa wakali lugambo baby
Nga kusperinga swazinika Obanga kukunganya tapeko ya mazika Ibya dala dala wampo nyabu gold nigga Obunoba na masowa ninebuga parkinga
Baby, forever you and I I will love you till I die Nga musilamu I will lie bit a lie Baby, I'll never let you go I will never, never, never let you go I will never, 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 never Never let you go
Atongoba, tongoba
Bigali wa miliani neba kugamba
Abizale Tongoba, tongoba
Aba batesi bagala kusule bakulonde
Tongoba, tongoba
Bigali wa miliani neba kugamba
Bigali Tongoba, tongoba
Aba batesi bagala kusule bakulonde
Kabichi We mwagala ntibe Kabichi Gwe mwagala mungeri ewe mirembe Tapukani Kabichi Mundo gwe mwagala mungeri ewe mirembe Tapukani Sichagala bwe mbamo sanze Galine vananyumirwa Mbuze ke mirembe Kali watenze mubita Na yari na ye mikwano Asana yo spesi Simulunda Simutaiza Sibwe manyaka zanyo Era olibwa mbuza Luache mufanto Muda munti Kabichi mwecho Kabichi Owangewe mwagala mungeri ewe mirembe Tapukani Katika bichi mama Kabichi Mungo mwagala mungeri ewe mirembe Tapukani Privacy yenji wechitiwa Simulingiriza Mwakabanga Kale wadolu mumbuza Unayebwa sirika Sikaka ansa Esimu weimba Simu soya soya Nze siri loya Hera oni wambuza Luache mufancho Kabichi mwecho Kabichi Kabichi Owangewe mwagala mungeri ewe mirembe Tapukani Kati kabichi mwecho cho kabichi mundo bomo akala munge yewe mirembe tanto kandi
Jangwe no Kupa penzi lote. biashara siku hizi wengi wananunua yule ulo mchagua kesho yake anazingua yashageuka biashara siku hizi wengi wananunua yule ulo mchagua kesho
macho yake anazingua zile I love you, I need you, I miss you. Kume misemo tu, ukweli upo moyoni. Zile I love you, I need you, I miss you.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaites, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the palm nut that goes into a mortar won't leave without a scar. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States government is saving lives in the Lake Chad Basin. Today, some 7 million people are suffering from severe hunger in the Lake Chad Basin. Thousands may have already experienced famine. Malnutrition is rampant, and over the past few years, the region has increasingly suffered numerous outbreaks of contagious diseases, such as hepatitis E, meningitis, measles, cholera, and even polio. The United Nations calls the situation a complex humanitarian emergency, a major crisis that is often the result of political instability, conflict and violence, social inequities, and poverty. In the Lake Chad region, one of the main contributors to the crisis is the Boko Haram terrorist group. For 15 years now, Boko Haram has attacked civilians in Chad, Niger, Cameroon, and Nigeria, causing instability and conflict. But the crisis is also caused by decades of neglect. A lack of rural development has left many communities vulnerable to extreme weather events, such as floods and drought. Since 1960, Lake Chad has also lost about 90% of its water. That means disaster for people whose livelihood directly depends on the lake, such as fishermen and farmers. And of course, there is a considerable ripple effect as people escaping hunger in one region strain the resources of the areas to which they move. The United States is committed to responding to people affected by this crisis. Working with our partners, we are helping states and communities prepare for disasters and to help people withstand crises. We also provide emergency humanitarian aid. So far in fiscal year 2017, with USAID in the lead, the United States government has provided more than $203 million worth of humanitarian aid to the countries of the Lake Chad Basin. This aid includes food, nutritional supplements, safe drinking water, hygiene kits, and emergency medical services. Yet the need is great and growing, and in the Lake Chad Basin, people are suffering. We urge our partners and all humanitarian donors to increase their level of support during this critical time of need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.